cancel the other things that I've said. I will be, well, I don't know. Okay. I can't help it. The historian in me has to give you the historical context of what we're talking about. Maybe mainly because it's helpful to me to put things where they belong in perspective on a timeline. And I know, you know the complaints that people learn history being forced to memorize dates and things like that that they don't like to memorize. But I'm going to give you a date that you have to memorize to start with today. That's the year 1688. If you back up 100 years, 1588, Mation is flourish, and a huge incident in British history. 1588. Does anybody know what that was? It was the defeat of the Spanish Armada. Remember I said the 16th century was the Spanish century. And they come in, the Spain comes into play in everything through that century. And they put together a mighty fleet in 1588, set out to conquer England, to reconquer England for the church. Their fleet was destroyed, mostly by hurricane-force bad weather, and then the rest by Sir Francis Drake and company, who finished them off. So in 1588, the Spanish fleet was sort of driven from the ocean. Lots of wonderful providential stories that go along with that. But it actually, what it did is it opened up a gap for England to get involved in settling the New World. And from 1588 to the early 1700s, England began pursuing colonization in America. And you know they succeeded, right? In Jamestown, Virginia, first permanent English settlement in the early part of the 18th century. And that was King James, was the king. We've talked about him. And then he was succeeded by his son, Charles I, who eventually was fired by Parliament. He didn't like the severance package. It included his head. But then Charles II became the king of England. And Charles II was a persecutor of the Presbyterians of Scotland, but they'd been persecuted before, and they'd had a difficult time initially with Oliver Cromwell, who transported several thousand of them to the New World as slaves, as indentured servants, one or the other. But that was nothing compared to what Charles II was going to do.
And he was given his power.
Yeah, it was the Scots who crowned Charles II, and of course he turned on them the second he had the power to do so, when he came back to England during the Restoration in 1660. So for the next 28 years, up until 1688, there was great persecution of Puritans in England and the Scottish Covenanters, Scottish Presbyterians. So over 28 years, it was a very difficult time for Reformed Christians in the British Isles due to persecution of the Anglican Church, which is also Protestant and also considered Reformed during that period. So there are all kinds of problems that attend that, of course. But the Puritans are the conservatives in the Anglican Church. They are certainly, considered the liberals in the Anglican Church. Because they wanted to continue change, and the Anglicans did not. They wanted to cling to some of their Roman Catholic forebears. James II, who came to the throne after Charles II, II passed off the scene. James II actually was Roman Catholic, or at least he married him. Both he and Charles were married to Roman Catholic women who brought priests into England and into the palace and began propagandizing for the Roman Church. And so Parliament, 1688, decided that King James II was an illegitimate king because he was Catholic, or at least he was promoting Roman Catholicism. He was promoting, it seemed like he was promoting religious freedom. The way he went about it was, we need to grant freedom of worship to the independents, to the dissenters of the Anglican Church, to be granted independence. And Catholics too, by the way. And it turns out that it was kind of bogus regarding the Protestants, but it was really the Catholics that he wanted to give free rein in England, bring in Catholic missionaries, re-evangelize England for the papacy. And Parliament was not having any of it. It was illegal for a monarch of England to be Roman Catholic. And so James had to go. And there were rival, when James II became king, there were rival claimants for the throne on that basis too, but unsuccessful. So James was only there for a couple years. And then he goes on the run because Parliament turns to Charles II's daughter, whose name is Mary. Everybody's daughter is named Mary. And she was married to the King of the Netherlands, King William of the Netherlands, and known as William of Orange. And of course, that's the color of the Dutch. The Dutch color is orange, and it symbolized their Protestantism and the House of Orange, which William is the master of and the king of. And so William and his wife Mary are turned to by Parliament as the legitimate heirs to the throne of England. So William and Mary are brought over from the Netherlands in 1688 and installed as King and Queen of England. And that is called, in England, historically, by historians, as the Glorious Revolution. And some call it the Bloodless Revolution, but I don't call it that because it wasn't. I mean, the installation of them as King and Queen was bloodless. They didn't have to chop off the head of Charles II, or of James II. He made a run for it and went to Ireland. And you can always make a bid for the president, for the royal seat of England from Ireland, because all the Catholics are going to rise up in your favor, which is what happened. Catholic armies were raised in Ireland against their English overlords, and France was brought into the picture, and French armies were sent to Ireland. And so James II decided to use Ireland as his platform to regain the crown of England. And this is in 1688 and 1689. And so King William gathers up the English army and he goes to Ireland. And they fight a war in Ireland. And it's the Catholic armies. The wearing of the green Catholic armies in Ireland against the Orangemen, represented by William of Orange and the English army. And in the end, William is victorious, and the James II's French soldiers and Irish soldiers are defeated by the English army in a couple of big battles. Thus, King William has secured his throne of England. And just as a side note, Ulster, which is Northern Ireland, becomes more and more Protestant. And Ulster becomes majority Protestant over the next couple centuries. Northern Ireland. The Republic of Ireland, which eventually becomes becomes a republic in the 20th century, but it's not at that time. It's still part of the British Empire, but it's mostly Catholic. So the northern part of Ireland is mostly Presbyterian. It's Presbyterian, Church of England, Anglican. And the rest of Ireland is mixed, but majority Catholic. And that, those particular demographic factors are going to be the most important demographic factors in the history of Ireland. It's going to be Protestant versus Catholic. And in Northern Ireland, their color is going to be orange. That, almost that color right there. And the Republic is going to be green. It's going to be their, kind of their color. And it's almost humorous now, but down through the centuries, you know, after all the revolutions, wars, and fightings, in the 20th century, when soccer and rugby and cricket all became a thing in England, professional sports, they did across the empire, and it includes Ireland. And so the Irish Catholic teams always, and usually are called Celtics, and the Northern Ireland teams, their color was orange, and they call themselves Billy's Boys in the 20th century, after William of Orange. And they all had fight songs for their teams. This is way off the track, by the way. It's just, but in recent years, well, so they sang their songs at all their sporting events.
Let's hear it.
No, no. No, it's illegal and you go to jail in Ireland if you sing it. And I always sing it when I'm there, though, but they haven't caught me yet. But it's, their favorite song is We Are Billy's Boys, and that's what they would sing at the sports events. The Protestants would all sing We're Billy's Boys, still. I mean, 300 years later, they're still Billy's Boys, and what they're referring to is we're Protestants. And one of the part of the verses of that song is we're up to our hips in Fenian blood. I mean, they're blood-curdling songs, and both sides have them. So the Catholic teams have their songs, but the Protestants have their songs. But the Fenians were a Catholic terrorist organization that preceded the Irish Republican Army. The Fenians were the terrorists of Ireland of the 19th century. So we're up to our hips in Fenian blood. I mean, they're serious about their anti-Catholic stand. And these are the sports teams, so you can imagine what kind of games those turned into in the 20th century. And they became so violent sometimes that finally the Parliament in England outlawed the team songs from Ireland. So nobody's allowed their team songs anymore because it eggs the opposite side into violence and so-called. But you can go on YouTube and listen to 10,000 Orangemen singing We're Billy's Boys if you want to. We won't do that. Question?
It lasted longer than 300 years. My sister, when she heard that I was going to have a date, one of my first dates, she said, he better not be Catholic.
Yeah, well, that's right. Okay. And her ancestors from Ireland, their name was Cromwell. So they were the third party in Ireland, the Anglo-Irish. So they're three different groups in Ireland, and that has got me to where I want to be after 1688, and that is that in Ireland, England had taken over Ireland a long time ago. The Irish chiefs, Ireland was full of clans, and each clan had a chief, and they all hated each other, and they fought all the time. And one of the clans made a big mistake when William of Normandy came in 1066 into England, and England fell to the Normans, and So those French knights, which amalgamated with the Anglo-Saxons in England, were a powerful army and good fighters. And an Irish clan invited the Normans to come over to Ireland and help them defeat their opponents. And so the Normans came to Ireland. They said, "This is really a great place. Look at all the green stuff, and this is wonderful." And so they took it over. And so that brought the English into Ireland by invitation only. And they never left. And so the Normans stayed, and these Norman knights built their own little independent empires all over Ireland. And that tradition of English, I'll give you a big word, hegemony, overrule in Ireland really began a long time ago in the 11th century, in a way. But it was really Henry VIII that began transplanting Englishmen and Scotsmen in Ireland. Irish just could not be controlled. And so the English decided to start planting English culture wherever they could in Ireland. And maybe the barbarians would see the light and start acting like civilized people. And it didn't really work that well, especially at first, with the Protestants that came as a result of Henry VIII. But after Henry, his son Edward VI, and then good Queen Bess, Queen Elizabeth, transplanted a lot of Englishmen and a lot of Scottish people in Ireland, because the Scots were known for being frugal, being good farmers, and working hard. And we're not talking about the Highlanders necessarily. We're talking about the Lowlanders of Scotland, the ones who had become Reformed, and of course, were Presbyterian. And so the English government began transplanting Scottish families in Ireland, give them a piece of land, and they make a blossom and turn a profit. And the crown of England prospers from that. And so a lot of Scottish families were brought over to Ireland. And in America, they're still going to be called Irish. But in their own minds, their ancestry is the Scottish Celts rather than the Irish Celts. Especially in Ulster, in Northern Ireland, there are four or five counties there, and their majority is going to be these transplanted Scotsmen, as well as English, Episcopal English, loyal English to the throne, not Puritans. So the gospel comes with the Presbyterians from Scotland into Ireland over a couple hundred year period of time. Well, after 1688, we know that in America, there's suddenly going to be, or not necessarily sudden, there's a trickle, let me put it this way, there's a trickle of Scottish people and Scots from Northern Ireland and from all over Ireland, not just Northern Ireland, but Scots who had been transplanted in Ireland. Some of them began to continue moving westward, and they came into America during that first century that England ruled over North America. And when Scots would come into some place like, say, Boston, which was a Puritan town, Puritan city, the Puritans were aghast at these Irish Presbyterians who were coming into America. They talked different, they dressed differently. They were fellow Protestants. They all held to the Westminster Confession, in terms of their churches, etc. The ones that were churched anyway. But the English in America didn't really like, they saw the Scots from Ireland as kind of an alien culture. And after the revolt in 1745 of Bonnie Prince Charlie, a bunch of Jacobite Scots, that is Highlanders, who in Scotland were mostly Catholics, but there were still among them a number of Presbyterians. They were all rounded up, a bunch of them, the ones that weren't executed, and shipped to North Carolina. So there's a migration into North Carolina from Scotland, which includes Highland, Presbyterian Highlanders who were on the losing side at Culloden. So there's been this trickle. As either as indentured servants or as slaves. And just to show you the kindliness, how the Covenanters were treated. Well, a lot of the Irish were treated in a similar, the Highlanders were treated in a similar fashion. A whole boatload of, just to give you an example, a whole boatload of Covenanters were put in irons in a ship that actually sank in the Orkneys, in the islands of the northern Scotland. Bad weather came, a ship sank, and they had several hundred Covenanters trapped in the hold. And they screamed to be released, to at least try and swim to shore. And the sailors locked down all the hatches and put locks on them, and the ship went down with hundreds of Covenanters trapped below decks. And they laughed as they did it, and then got in the boats and rowed to shore. Ironically, a few of those Covenanters did survive that sinking. That's how we know all about it. But to fall into the hands of the English army and then have an English court sentence you to hard labor in Barbados or wherever you were going to be sent was a death knell for a lot of people. So there's a trickle of Scottish and Irish Presbyterians coming into New World, coming into English North America. The Puritans, one Puritan wit made the comment that these Scots kept the Sabbath and everything else that wasn't tied down, because as they swept through, they just kept on going into the western parts of New England and of the middle colonies. And eventually, of course, they're going to come to Virginia also, from western Pennsylvania. They're going to come from south. Some of them are going to turn left. Some of them are going to turn right. And the ones that turn left come down the Shenandoah Valley, and I'm going to talk about them a little bit later. But by 1700, there are probably numbering in the low thousands of Presbyterians in America, and there's no Presbyterian church. And it wasn't long before these people were really separated from their theological roots. They kept moving westward constantly, and the church didn't keep up. There wasn't a church to keep up, really, in the beginning. So as Presbyterians became more numerous in places where they were allowed to be, like Pennsylvania and Maryland, that had religious freedom, at least in Maryland for a short time, that's where Presbyterianism is going to take root. In America is actually going to be in Western Maryland, Eastern Maryland on the Eastern Shore. And the man who really plants ecclesiastical Presbyterianism is a man named Francis McKemmy. Now, McKemmy was from Northern Ireland. And in America, the Protestants from Northern Ireland are going to be called Irish in the colonial days. America, they're called the Irish, because the Catholic Irish didn't come until the 1840s. So most of the Irishmen that came in colonial time were just called the Irish. Historians, to differentiate them from the Catholic Irish that come later on, a number of years ago, well, a century ago, began calling these Protestant Irish Scots Irish. That's American terminology. Not recognized in Ireland or England, but American historians, in order to try and understand the differences, called the Presbyterians the Scots-Irish. And most of them are Presbyterian. Some of them are Anglican, Episcopalian, of course, but the vast majority of them are Presbyterian. And they're coming from Ireland. But if you trace their roots back, their roots all go back into Scotland. And the reason they left Scotland was normally mixed with persecution for their religious beliefs. And they came to Ireland and were able to prosper until there were economic downturns or persecutions from the English government. And those continued. The flood of Scots-Irish is going to begin in 1710. So in the early 18th century, there's suddenly going to be a flood of Scots-Irish coming to America. And one of the main reasons is that the new monarch in England is Queen Anne, the last of the Stuarts. And she is going to persecute the Irish Presbyterians. Her government is going to make it difficult for them to continue in Ireland, both economically and in terms of their worship. And so a lot of them save up their pennies and they get on ships to America. So after 1710, there's this kind of the trickle of Scots and Scots-Irish becomes a steady stream from 1710 till American independence. And so by the time of, say, 1775, say, the beginning of American independence, there's probably more than 250,000 Scots in America, Scots and Scots-Irish. And that 250,000, are coming from Presbyterian homes, either in Scotland or Ireland. And there's a lot more history that we could talk about as to why they came and who came and all of that. Those are matters of personal interest and personal study and what have you. I want to get to Francis McKenna. He really is, he's the one who sets the tone for Presbyterians organizing in America. He is born in Ramelton in County Donegal, Ireland, in 1658. It's not too far from Derry, or Londonderry, as it's called, the last great walled city of Europe. It's the wall is still there in Derry, and Derry has just a wonderful, interesting history of defending themselves. It's the Catholic armies that made war against King William. Well, he was born in County Donegal, not too far from there, in 1658. So if you remember your dates, you know, it's 1660 is the restoration of King Charles II. And Francis McKemy is born right about that time, 2 years prior. He's born right about the time that John Bunyan is preaching and is about to be arrested and thrown in prison for 12 years. The guy who writes Pilgrim's Progress. Just to give you something to hang your hat on there. He's a contemporary of Bunyan. And Cromwell died in 58. And so that's the time that Francis McKenna was born, in a beautiful place in Northern Ireland. And growing up, I heard all the stories of Covenanters. In fact, his family was a Covenanter family in Ireland. 1670, he went to the University of Glasgow, and they're still under persecution from Charles II. He goes to the University of Glasgow, and he studies for the ministry in a very difficult time period, because Covenanter family, at a time that Covenanters and Covenanter families are illegal. Turns out he's kind of under the radar, and nothing ever happens to him other than becoming well-educated. And he was, his personality was so warm and so engaging. Everybody fell in love with Francis McKemy the second they met him. And so he sailed through the university, and pretty soon the killing times ended, and James II ended. ended and William and Mary came in, and the first thing they have Parliament do is pass the Toleration Act, which allows for independent congregations. It allows for Presbyterianism to flourish, not just in Scotland, but now you can be a Presbyterian in England or Ireland or wherever. And this is the time that Francis McKemmie is coming out of the university, is ordained in the Presbyterian Church. He ends up receiving a call in Northern Ireland and goes there to pastor a church. And while there, he hears from Presbyterians in America who continue writing back to their old presbyteries. The name of his presbytery is Laggan, L-A-G-G-A-N, in Northern Ireland. And a bunch of people from his district have moved to America, and they've gotten there, and there are no Presbyterian churches in America. And they write home to Laggan, and they say, send us a preacher. We have enough people here on the eastern shore of Maryland and in Delaware to start a church. We need a pastor, though. There are no institutions in America that are going to produce Presbyterian ministers. Neither Harvard nor Yale are going to produce Presbyterians just yet. And so that these people want a pastor. And here's this young Francis McKemmie, freshly ordained out of licensed to preach in his presbytery, and the presbytery says, would you like to go to America? And he sees that as a wonderful opportunity. He comes to America and settles in eastern part of Maryland. And Maryland is a proprietary colony. That means that the governor of the colony is a private individual, not appointed by the crown. It's not a royal colony. Pennsylvania is a proprietary colony. Who's the proprietor of Pennsylvania? Anybody know? William Penn. That's right. William Penn's father, who was an admiral in the Navy and was a millionaire, his father had loaned the King of England a ton of money, and the king couldn't pay it back, and so instead he gave him Pennsylvania, a couple million acres. And so William Penn's father got all of this land in what becomes known as Penn's Woods or Pennsylvania, but it's his son William who actually takes possession and comes to America, and actually he spent most of his time in England. He wasn't in America very long. But the Penn family are going to be the proprietors of Pennsylvania right up until independence, all the way up until 1776. Pennsylvania is going to be run by the Penn family as proprietors. All the other proprietary colonies are going to fail, or the king is going to take over the colony and they become royal. But there's this gap in the history of Maryland in which the land that today is Maryland was given to a proprietor, Lord Calvert, or Lord Baltimore, of the Calvert family. And they were Catholic, and they granted religious freedom in Maryland because they wanted religious freedom for Catholics to come there. And so Maryland becomes the only colony of the 13 colonies that has a lot of Catholics in it. In fact, most colonies don't have any, zero. The colony's either Anglican or Anglican Presbyterian or Quaker. Pennsylvania becomes a Quaker colony, and they grant total religious freedom. The Penn family throws the doors open to anybody who wants to come. And that's why Pennsylvania becomes the most prosperous and freest colony of the 13, by far. But Maryland is like that for a short time while the Calverts are in charge. And so Catholics that are trying to get out of England or Ireland or German Catholics, they come to Maryland because they know they can have a congregation, establish a church, etc. And that lasts for a few years until something happens and Maryland becomes a royal colony. The king takes over. As soon as the king takes over, the Anglican bishops take over. But before that happens, Francis McKemmie comes there and they establish the first Presbyterian church is constructed. It's called Rehoboth. It's still there. It's on the eastern shore of Maryland. There's a couple churches they plant in Delaware and eastern shore of Maryland. And before long, they have six Presbyterian churches, which includes the one in Philadelphia. And those six Presbyterian churches are organized into a presbytery. And it's the first one in America. It's organized by Francis McKemmie, who is a wonderful preacher. He's, as one of his contemporaries said, he was gifted with a rare sense of humor and had a marvelous personality and charm. And he was just the right kind of evangelist to come and gather these groups of Presbyterians who wanted to worship God according to the scriptures. So all along the Pocomoc River, and which was the main highway at the time, everything went up and down the Pocomoc in Maryland and Delaware, these little Presbyterian churches sprouted everywhere. And so they were, you know, initially under the Presbytery of Lagan in Northern Ireland until they organized their own presbytery. And one of the problems that's going to ensue is that whatever theological issues are going on in Ireland at the time are going to go on in America too, because more pastors are going to come. We got six churches, we need six pastors. And so six more Irish pastors come to pastor those churches, but they're bringing with them some of the controversies that have erupted in England and Scotland and Ireland during that time, theological controversies, which is interesting to see how they dealt with that. Now, of course, Philadelphia is going to become the center of American Presbyterianism. And today, all the historical archives of the United Presbyterian Church, which is the mainline church, and we have about as much in common with them as we do with Muslims, all of their Presbyterian archives are in Philadelphia. That's the headquarters of the United Presbyterian organization. And the presbytery, the first presbytery, very quickly is going to become Philadelphia-centered, within 20 years. And it's going to stay that way until the 20th century, well, even up until now, which is kind of interesting. Although Philadelphia remains a Quaker city. Quakers dominate Pennsylvania altogether, economically, religiously. But first presbytery is organized, and McKemmie wanted to build a church building. But you have to have permission from the Bishop of London to build a church. And so he sends a petition to the Bishop of London, but McKemmie's not going to wait for 6 months or a year for that petition to be examined and information to get back. He goes out and he hires all the workers, and they build a church while the Bishop of London's considering whether he's going to let them build a church. And by the time he gets around to it, of course, they've not only built a church, they've built five other churches and filled them up with congregants, etc., and just ignored whatever the government was going to tell them one way or the other. But the thing about McKemmie is that he wasn't just a preacher. He had a real keen economic sense of things. He was invited to preach in Barbados. There are a lot of Presbyterians in Barbados at this time. All of them exiled there. But now some of them are traders from Scotland who established merchant ties. And these guys have invited McKemmie to come to Barbados. If you look on a map, it's not that far from America. And he goes to Barbados and he takes a bunch of trade goods with him. And he sets up a trade network between a lot of his friends and folks back in Maryland and Delaware with Barbados. And he makes a couple million dollars. He has just a keen head for numbers, and he has organizational skills that nobody else appears to have at the time. And as one historian has said this, well, actually, it wasn't a historian. It was somebody who knew McKemmy. Said he's a jack of all trades, a preacher, a doctor, a merchant, an attorney, a counselor at law, and worst of all, a disturber of governments. And that was from one of his enemies. That was an evaluation of him from an enemy. And worst of all, a disturber of governments. Because when you started pushing Francis McKemmy around, he knew the law, and he knew it better than the colonial officials did. And so he would represent himself in court when he got sued, which was not frequently, by Anglican establishment in Maryland. As soon as Maryland became a royal colony, they sent a bunch of preachers over and they organized the whole state in parishes. Well, guess what? You know, Presbyterians aren't going to be part of parishes established by the Anglican Church. And so they get sued and they get hauled into court and stuff. Well, he knows every word of the Act of Toleration, and he knows how it applies, and he knows how it applies in America. And so McKemmy will represent other people or represent himself, and he's in court frequently arguing his cases and winning them all. He wins every case that comes up where some Anglican has gotten it in his head that he's going to continue the persecution of Presbyterians in America. And it's not going to work in the same way with Francis McKemmy. And he was great in everything that he did. And because litigation was so expensive, like it is today, you know, it was just as expensive back then, the church couldn't afford to do stuff. But Francis McKemmy could. So when people got sued, he could pay for it. He ended up having to pay court costs all the time. They were very expensive. And he just wrote a check. It always shocked the courts. It shocked the people that were bringing cases against him. But he had independent wealth that he had developed himself from scratch. You know, he owns merchant ships that are going to Barbados and back and other ports. He's a totally unique individual, and he's one of the most famous preachers in America already at this point. And he's, of course, very reformed and very evangelical. And when they suspended preachers, they could expect to see Francis McKemmy representing them. New York City did not belong to the English. Anybody know who New York City belonged to? The Dutch, the Netherlands, that's right. The Dutch, at this point in history, owned New York City. And there are 450 Dutch Reformed families in New York City. So there's a Reformed church in America, but it's Dutch. And it's in New York City. But they are highly sympathetic to the Presbyterians and help them out quite a bit. And then there's another 200 Huguenot families that have fled France and have settled in South Carolina and in Virginia. So there are French Reformed Church in different parts of America. So the Reformed Church is, and this is right around the turn of the century, around 1700, the Reformed Church is growing. And at this point, it's the Dutch and the Huguenot churches, French Reformed and Dutch Reformed churches, that are the majority of Reformed people in the country, are in the 13 colonies. The Presbyterians are growing, and they're going to grow by leaps and bounds, as I said, after 1710, when Queen Anne starts putting pressure on Northern Ireland again. Francis McKemmy is called the Apostle of American Presbyterianism. He went up to visit some people in New York, and a bunch of Presbyterians on Long Island invited him to come and preach at their home, which he did, knowing that he was going to be arrested. He decided it was time to test the governor of New York, who's an Anglican, and he's the royal governor, and he hates the Reformed Church, And here's this Presbyterian preacher, and here's his opportunity. So he arrests McKemmy and another preacher, and they throw him in jail. And he's in prison for 8 weeks before the court date. The governor made sure that it got stretched out. He's arrested by the sheriff of Long Island illegally. So when it finally came down to going to court, Francis McKemmy went in and read the Toleration Act to them, showed them his license to preach that had been, he's had for years and years and years. You know, when he came to America, because of the Act of Toleration, he was able to get a license to preach. So he didn't have to worry about this kind of stuff. And he decided to make New York a test case because it was the largest population in the colonies outside of Philadelphia. And he won his case. And not only did he win his case, I mean, it cost him $400, which in today's money is probably hundreds of thousands of dollars. But he won his case, and the governor of New York got arrested and shipped back to England by the crown, and the sheriff of Long Island went to prison. So that was the result of their efforts against Francis McKemmy. And he built the first Presbyterian church in Virginia on the Virginia Eastern Shore in Oneonkoc. That's where he lived for a while. He had a beautiful home in Oneonkoc, and you can go there today. And as you drive into Oneonkoc, into the town of Oneonkoc, there's a big brick Presbyterian church on the right-hand side, and it's McKemmy Presbyterian Church. It was planted by Francis McKemmy, and I think he's buried in that cemetery there. I'm not positive. Maybe it's just his wife.
What denomination are they now?
United Presbyterian. It's not a Reformed church anymore, but you can find various historical sites in Eastern Maryland and Delaware and on the Eastern Shore of Virginia, all of them associated with Francis McKemmy, the first Presbyterian missionary, if you will, to America, and established the first Presbytery in America, which is going to be dominated by Philadelphia. You know, within 20 years, but several other Presbyterian presbyteries are going to be organized also in the early 1700s, and one of the reasons that they end up organizing different presbyteries is because of theological controversy, disagreements among Presbyterians. I know you've never heard of any such a thing as that, but it doesn't take very long for that to happen once they've established these various churches. As I said at the beginning, they brought controversies with them from Europe, and their theological controversies. And the American Presbyterian churches have to decide, they have to decide on Westminster Confession, first of all. They want to be a confessional church, they need to adopt the Westminster Confession. And there's disagreement with that among Presbyterians who disagree with various aspects of the Westminster Confession. So there's going to be some theological debates that take place, and exceptions are going to be made where pastors can make exceptions to the Westminster Confession. And they're different exceptions than Presbyterians make today, which is interesting, and for various reasons. But McKemmy was so important to the establishment of Presbyterianism in America that he became well known to the Mather family in Boston. And he became a close personal friend with Increase Mather and John Cotton, who was part of the Mather family empire up there. And Increase and Cotton Mather, who knew McKemmy until he died, corresponded with him all the time and invited him to Boston. And he went to Boston and he preached in their churches. So Mr. Presbyterian had an influence even in New England among these Congregationalists who, in a few short years, are going to try and decide if they remain Congregationalists or become Presbyterian. and a lot of them are going to become Presbyterians.
It's about 5 up.
I know. I got it here. Thank you.
Sorry, I'm such a time warrior.
That's okay. I got 10:54 here. I just have one more quote that I want to give before we close. Francis McKemmie had corresponded with Increase Mather for more than 20 years, and he'd been in the Mather home. And for a man like Cotton Mather, who was nationally famous and internationally famous too, said of McKemmie, he said this in a letter that he wrote to a friend, that excellent person. He says, that brave man, McKemmie, he says that in his New York trial, he won a triumph. And Cotton Mather says this, the nonconformist religion, all the American denominations, in other words, Congregationalist, Baptist, Presbyterian, and all, have the blessing of God because of Francis McKemmie. That's what Cotton Mather said. He said, surely he did save the cause of religious liberty in America. And that was the view of his contemporaries. And it's also the view of a lot of church historians, that this one person made such a huge difference, not just in his own time, but for the future. He laid the groundwork. He didn't see the generations that followed. He did marry, and I don't believe he had any children, if I remember correctly. But he didn't. So he didn't see all the things that he did for the Lord, which are too numerous to relate. Was seed sowing, as it turned out. Now, in his own day, it looked like they were really succeeding and being prosperous, and the kingdom was advancing. But nothing like it was going to in the next generation. So he kind of laid the groundwork, and God used Francis McKemmie to bring the gospel to people who were really hungry for it, and had kind of left it behind at home when they moved to a new place where there's no church. But God saw fit to bring McKemmie. And then as churches were founded, he would write letter back to Lagan or to other presbyteries that he was familiar with in Scotland, say, send us ministers. And they did. And things went from there. We will pick up in 2 weeks. Thanks. What's that?